from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And in 2016, over 3,500 people hiked on the John Muir Trail in California's High Sierra. That's a lot more than anyone imagined when the 211-mile trail running from Yosemite Valley to Mount Whitney was founded over 100 years ago. With increased usage taking a toll on the route, we discuss new efforts in this segment of Forum to preserve the trail's history and environmental integrity. And joining us in studio is Marla Starks. She's president of the John Muir Trail Foundation. Welcome.
Welcome. Hello.
And we also want to say hello to Tim Davis, who's joining us. He's writing a history of the trail. Welcome, Tim Davis.
How do you do?
Good. Good to have you. And Marla, let me begin with you. Let's talk about this idea to really, well, ensure that the trail would not only be of use and continued use, but be authentic. And we'll get into that in the course of things. But started with you backpacking?
Yes, actually, I had backpacked with my brother and sister when I was in my 20s and then revisited that in my 60s, of all things, with some friends that were actually backpacking that trail. And once you see the region, you're just stunned by its remoteness and beauty. And you can also see that it is showing a great deal of wear and tear from use. And the total use that goes on that trail is considerably higher than what you just mentioned. We're estimating it somewhere roughly around a quarter of a million people because they come in through all sorts of side trails to get in. There are many loop trails up there, and all of them want to be, all of the people that are out there traveling like to be on the John Muir Trail.
It's listed in social media. I mean, it's one of the best trails to hike in the country.
Possibly in the world. I was actually in Truckee last weekend and found a book that featured the 100 top hiking trails in the world, and the John Muir Trail was one of the few trails listed in the state of California and in the nation. An extraordinarily beautiful piece of terrain with deep, deep history in America's conservation history.
So you have worked on, assiduously, I might add, created an organization to restore, and we're talking about an organization that had the good fortune of getting some beer money. I don't know if that's...
We did.
That's really what it is, isn't it?
It is indeed. We were quite fortunate. I was fortunate in finding a group of colleagues and friends with a great deal of expertise to give some advice and some guidance with how to move forward. And we did reach out to the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company in Chico, where Ken Grossman and the Grossman family were generous enough to provide some substantial seed funding to get us going.
And you're talking about historic restoration as well as physical restoration.
We are. Ironically, my paths crossed with Tim Davis at the National Park Service Historic American Landscape Survey, who's also on this call, a year ago. And at the same time, as a matter of coincidence, a deep research project was underway in Washington, D.C. to preserve the history of this trail, which, of course, dates back to a time that was an extraordinary one in this nation's history.
And let's talk a little bit about that history with you, if we could, Tim Davis. I mean, this was a time where lots of trails were being blazed. 1915 trail is mapped, but they couldn't build it that way. In the 30s, it goes up Mount Whitney. I mean, it's gone through a whole series of sort of iterations.
Yeah, and you can trace the use of trails in the Sierra, of course, back to Native American trails, to cattle and sheep herder trails in the late 19th century, to the Whitney Survey coming in 1864, and even to John Muir rambling around. He makes several trips down into the area that becomes the John Muir Trail. What the people who create the John Muir Trail do is they build on these explorations. They often, in large part, follow existing trails, but they're very, for the most part, primitive trails. And what they introduce is the idea of a connecting link between Yosemite and the Kings Canyon area and Mount Whitney.
But this particular trail that we're talking about, the John Muir Trail, it's a trail that goes back even before the Appalachian Trail, and it goes across cliffs, and there's a lot to eke out there in terms of just making it accessible and as optimal a way as possible. We're talking about a lot of isolation and a lot of construction necessary, right?
Yeah, I think you can make a case that it's the oldest long-distance trail in America. The Long Trail in Vermont's Green Mountains was conceived around 1910, so the John Muir Trail was officially authorized in 1915, but people were thinking about it by the 1890s. And the Long Trail is finished in 1930. There's also the Skyline Trail up in Oregon, which initially goes from Mount Hood to Crater Lake. And, of course, like you say, the Appalachian Trail isn't conceived until 1921 and is finished a lot later. But, I mean, along with being, you know, arguably the oldest, it's certainly one of the most impressive, both in terms of conception and the location and construction, because, as you noted, it goes through incredibly challenging and incredibly scenic terrain.
What about making it authentic, getting back to the original way the trail was? Is that even possible?
That's a difficult task to undertake. What we're trying to do, instead of making it accurate to the way it was originally designed and engineered by state engineer McClure in 1916, is really trying to take the existing network of trails that are out there and aligning them in a way that is most authentic to its original route and the way it was described in many of the very early guidebooks and journal entries that we located in the archives in a number of different libraries, Bancroft Library, the Sierra Club Libraries, the California State Archives, in order to find the most authentic route. So our team of trails people took a look at that, and we have, in fact, realigned that, and we're presenting it for review to the various groups to take a look and see what they think. It does start in Yosemite Valley. It goes up to Tuolumne Meadows and makes a beautiful traverse across the meadow by Parsons Memorial Lodge and Lambert Dome, and then heads south. An extraordinary engineering effort to have achieved at that time.
An extraordinary thing to see. I mean, let's just talk about what we're visualizing here, or trying to visualize on the radio for our listeners.
You know, it's hard to describe. I had backpacked, as I said, when I went out there with my friends. It was an extraordinary vista. The elevation is hard to grasp. People may know about the tour of Mont Blanc in the Alps. You think that is a high elevation trail. Their highest point on that tour is 9,000 vertical feet. The John Muir Trail passes exceed 10,000 vertical feet right away, and right in the center you have five consecutive passes that are at 12,000 vertical feet or higher. And it really presses your lungs. You are on the top of the California snowpack. This is such a dense snowpack that it serves water to 30 million people in California. California agriculture would not survive without that water flow. And the agricultural community, when you're in the Central Valley, you can look up and see that magnificent snow-capped range. I think we all kind of take it for granted because it's right there, and we all go to Mammoth to ski and Lake Tahoe to enjoy the recreation. But right in the middle of our state is an extraordinary high elevation terrain that is really recognized worldwide as tremendously scenic.
And we're talking about a trail that goes over 11 passes and is pretty steep and rugged. And I'm just going to invite our listeners to join us here. If you've actually hiked the John Muir Trail, we'd love to hear from you. What makes it unique? And what would you like to see its steward prioritize? A lot of questions about not only restoration, physical, but also environmental, and in other ways getting back to, as much as possible, the authenticity of that trail. You can give us a call now, and I invite you to join us at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and you can call us and join us now at that number. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get on in touch with us on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. Our guest, Marla Stark, here in studio, is president of the John Muir Foundation, and the John Muir Trail Foundation is seeking to protect these storied routes from heavy use. We'll talk about that in a moment. We also have Tim Davis with us on the line. He's a historian with the National Park Service's Historic American Landscape Survey and is currently writing a history of the John Muir Trail. So what about that, Marla, just in terms of heavy use? We've got a real problem there, don't we?
You know, it is. It's accessible, surprisingly, compared to other routes. You don't have to take long plane flights. There are roads that get you to within 10 miles of the trail. And I think because it has this tradition that resonates with both the young and the old, it's become something that people really want to do, kind of on your bucket list to get done. And it is seeing what is essentially a tidal wave of public access that is washing over the national parks that it goes through. I think Yosemite National Park this year is expecting in excess of 4 million visitors. And those people are spilling out into the backcountry in ways that I don't think were ever really anticipated. And it's pressing each one of the four land agencies there to come up with regional strategies to try to address this.
And we'll get to your calls and emails in just a moment here, but I want to go back to you, Tim Davis, if I may, because I think you're on record as saying that the Sierra Club maybe plays a little loose with the history of the trail, and you're the historian here. Native Americans were there, but so were prospectors and herders, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the Sierra Club plays loose with the history of the trail. I would say that the idea of trying
to...
go ahead. I'm saying that that there was a trail before then.
Yeah.
Before it was officially, there were segments of the trail. But I think the idea of trying to get to Defy as an historian, I don't look so much for what the, try to define what is the correct trail, just like you wouldn't try to find the correct political thing or something, but to look at how where the trail was and what it did and how it functioned both physically and socially and conceptually at different periods in its history. And there have been major relocations, as well as many minor ones. And to be honest, I think you could play devil's advocate and say that John Muir and Will Colby, who more than anyone else was responsible for the trail happening, would say that this overcrowding, this tremendous popularity, means that the John Muir Trail is doing exactly what it was supposed to do, which is introduce people to the wonders of the High Sierra and inspire them, hopefully not just to broadcast their achievements on social media, but to inspire them to work in an active way for preservation.
And we'll bring our callers on, and we start with you. Shovika, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. So I have hiked parts of the John Muir Trail around Yosemite National Park, and it's wonderful that a lot of people are taking refuge in nature, like, you know, it's becoming more accessible. But what I can't prevent noticing is a lot of irresponsible behavior as well on the trails and the national parks all around, including the John Muir Trail. So I think we do need some restraint on the foot traffic or some policy around that, just like what we do for the top of the Half Dome in Yosemite and many other places in the world, because I really feel that the more foot traffic, the more irresponsible behavior, it's just going to cause more damage to our nature long term.
Yeah, and we particularly saw that when the government shut down in the national park. Shovika, thank you for that call. Marla Stark, can you address that?
Yes, I think
it's a concern to you too.
Your observation is spot on. Yeah. We had a good example of what happens when people are unsupervised and in the wilderness with the federal shutdown. Joshua trees being cut down, mountains of garbage being left in their wake. One of the things that we wanted to do right away as a foundation was to see if we could improve and enhance ranger patrols across the region. They had been declining over time because of changing priorities within the federal agencies, largely for forest management and fire control, fire prevention. So we need those backcountry rangers out there. They not only provide the search and rescue and helicopter relief and remote emergency medical support, but they're also there to make sure that people understand and adhere to leave no trace principles and walk through the wilderness without creating harm. So we're working on that very hard. If you go to our website, you'll see that we've got a page dedicated to the backcountry rangers.
Now, what about traffic control, though? I mean, it's a big problem.
Very hard thing to do, because if you think about it, it's 220 miles long, roughly, and about 20 miles wide. There are, I don't know, 30 or 40 access trails to get in. This is very remote, very difficult to do. The agencies try to collaborate as much as they can. We're hoping to bring funds and volunteers to support their collaborative efforts to improve that. But it's going to be a big challenge, just like it is to manage the national parks that are just getting overwhelmed with visitors.
Okay, Marla Stark is president of the John Muir Foundation, and we have a caller from Marshall, and that's you, Jeremy. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
I just want to bring perspective up that I've discovered over the years, having hiked in my lifetime now for over 60 years from just after birth and shortly thereafter when I began to remember it, we were raised as Sierra Clubbers, and with a lot of reverence, actually, a sense of reverence to the High Sierra. It's kind of a church for me. And you've been talking to my brother about his rangering. And what I've noticed over the last few years is a shift in the focus of why people are there. It's become popular as a kind of a bucket list item by adventure sports practitioners. And I would just summarize it by saying that the focus has shifted towards accomplishment instead of experience. And it's a gigantic shift, because the people that you see on the trail now have ultralight gear. They've got their earbuds in. They've got a solar panel up on their hat or the top of their pack. Their packs are ultralight. You can see right through them. And they've already picked out by the course, by all the work that's been done journalizing, they've picked out the next campsites all the way down the road. And they're just planning on getting there, shutting down for the night, getting up in the morning and getting back on the track. They never go off trail to explore and experience. It's like they've got blinders on, I swear. In my mind's eye, I see them with blinders on.
You see, thanks for sharing that, Jeremy. Good to hear from you. See that shift, Marla Stark? You agree with that?
I think you do see that shift. I think from an ordinary citizen, all visitors are welcome. But if you're in this extraordinary space, you have to ask the question of why don't you bring a notebook, a sketchbook, or a camera to enjoy the space rather than cover the maximum distance you can with the ultralight equipment you can and move from dawn till dusk. And it's such rugged terrain that you can't look up. You have to watch your feet as you're scrambling over very rugged terrain. So you're missing a lot of the beauty of the space. I run into older people who are still hiking the John Muir Trail into their 70s and 80s. And it's one of the things that they observe, that it's a shame so much of this is being missed because it is extraordinary space to see. You really need to see it. I think Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of our great American philosophers, came out to meet with John Muir to talk with this experience, and it made its way into this basic American philosophy of being out in nature, reading good books, and taking action when you see appropriate. Although I think he encouraged Mr. Muir to kind of abandon the space in his old age, because he was making his way out there at a time when very challenging.
Another caller joining us. I'm sorry, Tim, you want to say something here? Tim Davis?
Yeah. I was going to say, to stick with Muir for a second, he famously was quoted as saying that he abhorred the word hiking, that he believed people should saunter through the wilderness, yeah. That they should take their time, and it should be almost a religious. He equated it to a pilgrimage. But they should saunter, not hike, and certainly not speed hike.
I like that idea of sauntering. Sherry, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say that my husband and I hiked the John Muir Trail in 2016, and it was one of the most extraordinary experiences. You know, we hiked the Sierras a lot, but the John Muir Trail was just outstanding. And for the most part, we found that people were very respectful of the church they were in. To quote the last caller, we did see a lot of people. We took it at about 10 miles a day, which took us 3 weeks to do it, and I wouldn't do it any differently. People were blowing by us doing it 20 miles a day and missing a lot. But I still think those people are changed by the experience.
Well, clearly even changed you. You said what one of the best experiences of your life, yeah?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And not a bucket list item. Anyway, John Muir was one of my heroes. But the Sierras are extraordinary, and I do think people underestimate how difficult of a journey that 220 miles is.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for that call. We're getting this kind of testament here. I'm reading a comment by a listener named Eric who says, I just wanted to share that my friends Jeff and Emily met on the John Muir Trail back in 2014, fell so hard in love that they moved in together immediately afterward, and they will get married this June. Here's a comment from a listener named Peter who says, some research suggests that general dispersed camping, in which no specific restrictions apply, but hikers are urged to use established sites, is by far the greatest total destructive impact. Yet this is by far the dominant management policy along the John Muir Trail. Does the John Muir Trail Foundation have an approach to the problem of overuse of specific resources such as campsites? That's you, Marla Stark.
I mean, we're learning. The experts in this area are the four land management agencies themselves. They have very robust and carefully crafted wilderness plans. We'll learn more about that. We certainly do want to take a look at excessive campsites. I think the map at Inyo National Forest, where Ansel Adams took many of his prime photographs at Thousand Islands Lake, is one of the examples of where campsite density has grown to a stage where the only remaining strategy for the agencies is to simply bar camping. So there are pretty substantial swaths around those magical lakes, Garnet Lake and Sapphire Lake and Emily Lake and Thousand Island Lakes that are now barred for overnight camping. So we're hoping to see if we can learn more and assist with funds and volunteers to improve management strategies across that region. So hopefully that won't happen.
Looking at a comment from a listener named Brooke that I want to get on the record here, she writes, "Don't knock lightweight equipment," followed by about 20 exclamation marks. All right, let me get another caller on here. Alex, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So my dad and I actually hiked the John Muir Trail about 9 years ago when I was 23 and he was 69, and we did it in 13 days and surprisingly didn't see very many people on the trail at all, which was amazing. But then when we got to Mount Whitney, we saw hundreds, and it was really surprising. And so my question is what the impacts on Mount Whitney and how that gets managed. You know, a lot of people building rock shelters and all sorts of strange behaviors there.
Yes, the Whitney Portal is one of the most heavily impacted and probably one of the most complex management strategies that the Inyo National Forest faces. I'm not even sure I can wade into that. They've tried everything, and there are just so many people that try to access the John Muir Trail beginning at that portal and just try to hike straight up and back. It is the highest point in the contiguous 48 states. It's one of those things that people love to get on the top and take a picture of at 14,500 feet. It has complicated oxygen and altitude restrictions. The terrain going up there is heavily rocky, very difficult for it to recover. I'm not sure I can inform that decision much. The federal management teams are working very hard to do their best to manage that area.
Tim, can we go to you here on this, Tim Davis?
Yeah. Yeah, and actually to combine the last two callers, I think you can make a somewhat of a counter-argument that both the John Muir Trail and Mount Whitney, the insane crowding, actually helps preserve the wilderness, helps preserve the broader spaces of Sequoia, Kings Canyon, and those other wilderness areas. That just the way the parks were developed in general, channeling people into these corridors that can then be developed for their use gets a whole lot of people out there to enjoy some sort of, they feel like, a wilderness experience. And again, hopefully convince them to help preserve the wilderness. While those who want a more solitary or primitive wilderness experience are allowed, it keeps those people out of the broader part of the Sierra. You could look at Mount Whitney sort of like Yosemite Valley. The almost Coney Island-like crowding satisfies most people's needs and makes them feel like they've been to the mountains, that they've had a great wilderness experience. And hopefully, again, that will translate to support for the preservation of America's scenic treasures.
Again, Tim Davis is with the National Park Service's Historic American Landscape Survey. And another caller joining us from Santa Rosa. Tim, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I did 100 miles of the Muir Trail in 1975. The beauty, still probably the most favorite experience of my life. It was awesome. There were stretches for like 4 days at a time where we saw nobody. I was in Evolution Meadow, and we were the only people camping in the whole meadow. Just down the other side of the Muir Pass is still the place I go in my mind for meditation. That's just awesome.
That sounds like the beauty is well engraved in your mind. And I thank you for that call. Good to hear from that, too.
It is beautiful. And what's, I think, interesting is that the beauty of the place, as well of its scientific intrigue, captured two major universities in the Bay Area, Stanford and UC Berkeley, were a lot of the academics and scientists who made their way up to explore this area just before the John Muir Trail was engineered and routed. David Starr Jordan was out there with his wife. At the turn of the century, just getting to Kings Canyon or Sequoia National Park and Yosemite National Park was extremely difficult. There were no roads.
There were a lot of pack mules, I think.
Yeah, awful lot of mules had to be used. I think they are the unsung heroes of that area. And these professors and scientists and academics from actually all over the country, but predominantly from UC Berkeley and Stanford, were going up there to study it. And it was their efforts at alpine biology and geology and glaciology that really changed the sciences in the United States. And then resulted in this organization called the Sierra Club that was largely academics and well-educated group, and they worked hard to make sure that this trail could be cut in a north-south route, that it was as high as possible. And I think Wilbur McClure, the engineer that designed it, made sure that it went at a very gentle slope despite the rugged terrain. He was a highway guy, and he wanted to make sure you could traverse it easily. So it's a tremendous treasure up there that has connections deep in the Bay Area and in the nation.
And Marla Stark, again, is president of the John Muir Trail Foundation. And Tom writes, I hiked the JMT 2 years ago with my blind hiking buddy. Having a hiking trail that is so well constructed and maintained that a person with his challenge could enjoy it, it's a real treasure.
It is.
And so we get those kind of comments. And people who want to help out, Marla?
Go to the John Muir Trail Foundation.org. We have various ways to donate there. We also have a GoFundMe campaign going right now to support the backcountry rangers that we rely upon. If you go to GoFundMe, JMT Backcountry Rangers, put in some money there. It'll go straight to the ranger teams out there. And I guess one final note, the route of the John Muir Trail was largely driven by fly fishermen. The key men were there. They wanted to make sure that they could fish all the way through. So it meanders through these extraordinary landscapes of water, and there's wonderful trout everywhere.
Still good fishing. Marla Stark, thank you so much for joining us. Marla Stark, again, is president of the John Muir Trail Foundation. Thank you, Tim Davis. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
Tim Davis is a historian with the National Park Service's Historic American Landscape Survey. And KQED's Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Ariana Prail. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Katie McMoran. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this program, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.